Good evening. If you'd permit me, I think I'll read the Darshan message for the 15th of August, 2015, released by the Sri Aurobindo Ashram yesterday, taken from Savitri. His was a spirit that stooped from larger spheres into our province of ephemeral sight, a colonist from immortality, a pointing beam on earth's uncertain roads. His birth held up a symbol and a sign. His human self, like a translucent cloak, covered the all-wise who leads the unseeing world. Affiliated to cosmic space and time, and paying here God's debt to earth and man, a greater sonship was his divine right. The denotation is that he was writing about Ashwapati in the Yoga of the King. The connotation for us is that it is an apt description of his own being. So tonight, we continue in the chapter on matter, the 24th chapter in the Life Divine. Let's note that it was this weekend, a year ago, that we began our study of the Life Divine. So far, he has described to us that in this chapter, the body is often viewed in spiritual practice as a block and matter, a dark and dreary place in which the soul must find an avenue of escape. But for Sri Aurobindo, this is a discourteous view of the material world. Matter is drawn from reality, just as that supreme reality figures itself through its supramental self-visioning as a harmonious distribution of its single self into multitudes and multitudes of equally stationed and valid perspectives, all held within its one view, that there is an immense diversity held in an absolute unity, and that this supramental consciousness distributes itself through mind, so too does that enormous reality empower itself through its chit shakti in the life force. And matter too is designated a role in this universe by representing conscious being, sat, succinctly becomes matter here. And so, if matter is an imperfect precipitate arriving here through the dividing action of mind, empowered to manifest through the force of life, it is still real. Sri Aurobindo then poses a question and answers what was thrown to us a page or two earlier, where he says, but still the question remains, why energy should take the form of matter. And so now he returns to his theme This section opens with this paragraph. But why this phenomenal and pragmatic division of an indivisible existence? It is because mind has to carry the principle of multiplicity to its extreme potential, which can only be done by separativeness and division. To do that, it must, precipitating itself into life to create forms for the multiple, give to the universal principle of being the appearance of a gross and material substance instead of a pure or subtle substance. It must, that is to say, give it the appearance of substance which offers itself to the contact of mind as stable thing or object in an abiding multiplicity of objects, and not of substance which offers itself to the contact of pure consciousness as something of its own eternal pure existence and reality, or to subtle sense as a principle of plastic form freely expressive of the conscious being. In other words, matter to serve this principle of ultimate distribution must be able to define itself at the other end of separativity. It can't be lost in fluidity. It can't float in a cloud. It must become definite, at least in its appearance of substance. It must seem to stand in all this separativity as definite objects. So, mind, through life, then, creates form by which this pure substance of sheer being is made material. It is through the conjoint action of the dividing mind and the empowering life that matter is established here at the basis of the cosmos in apparently separate forms. And mind obviously requires stability in order to function, and so these defined forms have a tremendous, indispensable utility in the startup of the cosmos. The contact of mind with its objects creates what we call sense. But here it has to be an obscure, externalized sense which must be assured of the reality of what it contacts. The descent of pure substance into material substance follows, then, inevitably on the descent of Satchit-Ananda through supermind into mind and life. So, the contact of mind with its objects creates what we call sense. So mind extending itself towards objects creates sense. In other words, the senses are extensions of mind. Mind is not the result of the play of senses. Rather, we are moving again from the inner dimensions of the cosmos towards the external, descending from above down. So let's keep in mind the necessity of this cosmic chain as it reaches itself further and further down, a higher level implying a lower, moving from unpartite unity to what seems to be absolute fragmentation when we get to the base of matter. But all of this is marking the descent of Satchit-Ananda through the distributive harmonious agency of supermind, through the divisive vicegerent mind, and the empowerment of life into the encasement of this same reality in matter, that chain of being. He continues, it is a necessary result of the will to make multiplicity of being and an awareness of things from separate centers of consciousness the first method of this lower experience of existence. So this is willed. This is intended. The will translates being into multiple centers to start the cosmic experience. If we go back, he writes, to the spiritual basis of things, substance in its utter purity resolves itself into pure conscious being, self-existent, inherently self-aware by identity, but not yet turning its consciousness upon itself as object. So again, this is Satchit-Ananda, that pure basis of being which is conscious of itself, conscious, chit, but it is self-existent, sat. He doesn't bring the principle of Ananda in here because we're looking at the sheer terms of existence at this point, not at the experience of existence. Supermind, he continues, preserves this self-awareness by identity as its substance of self-knowledge and its light of self-creation. So in supermind comes in as an agency to draw upon the reality of Satchit-Ananda. It preserves its identity through this self-awareness. But for that creation, presents being to itself as the subject-object, one and multiple of its own act of consciousness. So remember, in the unpartite unity of Satchit-Ananda, there is no self and other. There is no I'm here and you're there. That doesn't exist. But in supermind, the idea of there being an object and a subject does come into being, but there is no cleavage between the two. It is the same being experienced both as object and as self regarding object. There is no division. Subject, object, one and multiple of its own act of consciousness. So not only can it project itself, as it were, as an object of its consciousness, but it can have multiple centers of self-projection and not be lost in the multiplicity, never surrender its subjectivity in any of these many stances, never lose the objectivity either. They're not simply hallucinations of the subjective consciousness. They're real extensions of being, but all is held within that oneness. So oneness and diversity are utterly the same thing. There is no loss of unity in diffusion of being in the supramental. Now he digs a little deeper, recalling what he's written before. In other chapters, being as object is held there in a supreme knowledge which can, by comprehension, see it both as an object of cognition within itself and subjectively and subjectively as itself, but can also and simultaneously by apprehension project it as an object or objects of cognition within the circumference of its consciousness, not other than itself, part of its being, but a part or parts put away from itself. That is to say, from the center of vision in which being concentrates itself as the knower, witness, or purusha. So it can play without introducing real disunity at this difference between subject and object. It projects itself in this apprehending thing, because once out there it has to reach to apprehend, right? And that's how the term comes into play here. And the comprehensive of everything is within, but now it's projected out. And he continues from this. The apprehending, obviously, leads to the variegation of forms. And he moves forward from that. We have seen that from this apprehending consciousness arises the movement of mind, the movement by which the individual knower regards a form of his own universal being as if other than he. So this is what the mind does. It takes it to a farther extent, an extension in which the projected object, or even the selfhood of that projected self, can regard itself as if separate from its home consciousness, so to say. But in the divine mind, he writes, there is immediately, or rather simultaneously, another movement or reverse side of the same movement, an act of union in being which heals this phenomenal division and prevents it from becoming even for a moment solely real to the knower. So at this level of experience, as mind begins to function as a distributive power of the supermind, in that proximitous range, the divine mind mediates between supermind and mind. And where there would seemingly be division, the divine mind reinforces, heals the gulf, closes the divide, does not permit the individual movement to be lost in phenomena. So it mediates between the two. This act of conscious union, Sri Aurobindo writes, is that which is represented otherwise in dividing mind obtusely, ignorantly, quite externally, as contact and consciousness between divided beings and separate objects. And with us, this contact in divided consciousness is primarily represented by the principle of sense. So the conscious union in mind, which it grasps for that, it begins with the power of sense to reach out and touch the objects and begin to then construct or reconstruct closure, to know, to bring what is unknown into knowledge. So in mind proper, that closure is attempted through sense. On this basis of sense, he says, on this contact of union subject to division, the action of the thought mind founds itself and prepares for the return to a higher principle of union in which division is made subject to unity and subordinate. Substance, then, as we know it, material substance, is the form in which mind, acting through sense, contacts the conscious being of which it is itself a movement of knowledge. So, sense contact leads to constructive thought. And all of this is a movement back towards the eventuality of unity, beginning from sense, and then thought constructing sense into knowledge, obviously indirect, but looking for that unity of experience. So this is what substance is. It's mind acting through sense contacts and arriving at these distributed forms. This, again, is something of a translation of the picture that we have from the Sankhya philosophy, that manas extends through its sensory apparatus into the objects which are subtle and then finally gross. So the gross objects are really derived from the subtle from the action of the sense mind itself, the sense mind from general awareness, and up and up and up we go, back to the origination of reflective consciousness acting in nature, prakriti. So above to the below. But mind, by its very nature, tends to know and sense substance of conscious being, not in its unity or totality, but by the principle of division. It sees it, as it were, in infinitesimal points, which it associates together in order to arrive at a totality. And into these viewpoints and associations, cosmic mind throws itself and dwells in them. So starting from division, the mind must try to reconstruct unity from these infinitesimals. Infinitesimal means infinitely small. But note, he says, infinitesimal points. This has real strength in his argument because it isn't that matter is seen to disappear into infinitely divisible forms below. Suggests that there is something at the basis. Even if they are infinitesimal, there are still points of reality in this extreme divergence from unity, matter being that extreme divergence. So dwelling, creative by its inherent force as the agent of real idea, bound by its own nature to convert all its perceptions into energy of life, as the all-existent converts all his self-aspectings into various energy of his creative force of consciousness, cosmic mind turns these, its multiple viewpoints of universal existence, into standpoints of universal life. It turns them in matter into forms of atomic being, instinct with the life that forms them, and governed by the mind and will that actuate the formation. Here again, he's making explicit this chain of causation. Real being, cosmic mind, life, matter. Mind pushes the life force to install materiality in atomic form. The variety of life is one way that the immensity of this being expresses itself, and the atomic arrangement of the cosmos is how it expresses itself in matter. So in life, it's variegation. In matter, it's the extreme distribution of atomic reality. Yes, we understand that physics has moved beyond viewing the universe as founded only on atoms. We know that atoms can be subdivided and there are many particles beneath the atomic. We understand that now. Sri Aurobindo was writing this in 1914, 15, 16, and dealing with the physics that he knew at the time. But his viewpoint is still the same. There is a fundamental basis of matter, just as there is a fundamental reality from which matter flows. Sat has established itself as materiality. And how? At the same time, the atomic existences which it thus forms must, by the very law of their being, tend to associate themselves, to aggregate. And each of these aggregates also instinct with the hidden life that forms and the hidden mind and will that actuate them bears with it a fiction of a separated individual existence. So there's extreme division, yes? Each thing seems to be in and of itself. But there is a power of unity at the basis of the cosmos, which insists that it moves back towards unity, and its first method of doing that is aggregation. So these atoms can't exist alone. They must congregate. They must build molecules. Molecules must build still larger forms of connectivity, and the bridge back to unified being has begun. Each such individual object or existence is supported according as the mind in it is implicit or explicit, unmanifest or manifest, by its mechanical ego of force, in which the will to be is dumb and imprisoned, but nonetheless powerful, or by its self-aware mental ego, in which the will to be is liberated, conscious, separately active. So this aggregation becomes a marked force as the universe begins to move, to grow, to evolve. This will, which is implied in the universe, this consciousness, which is implied in the universe, begin to articulate themselves. At first, the will to be is dumb and imprisoned. That means it has no voice. It's without voice. It can't speak. It's locked up. But nonetheless, it's powerful. It eventuates, does it not, in what he describes next, a self-aware mental ego, in which the will to be, still active and present, is liberated, conscious, separately active. The ego can announce its presence. It's found its voice. It's trying to find a way to break out of the prison. And yet, it is still lost in that separative fiction. It thinks it is not part of a larger whole. So the individual object, in a sense, is reinforced by the mechanical ego of force. And in the mind, the mental ego serves the same function. So that fiction of separativity is maintained at these lower chords of our being. Thus, not any eternal and original law of eternal and original matter, but the nature of the action of cosmic mind is the cause of atomic existence. It's the nature of mind to arrive at this kind of fragmentation, this kind of separativity, and to insist upon it. The mind's principle of division results in atomic existence. Matter is a creation, and for its creation, the infinitesimal, an extreme fragmentation of the infinite, was needed as the starting point or basis. Ether may and does exist as an intangible, almost spiritual support of matter, but as a phenomenon, it does not seem, to our present knowledge at least, to be materially detectable. This was added by Sri Aurobindo when he revised the Life Divine. It was absent in the original article in the Arya. So whether or not we can demonstrate that ether is there, Sri Aurobindo suggests that it is present, even if it is not materially detectable. We still have theories from physicists which include ether as a principle in the constitution of the universe, and of course many more physicists object to that idea and disregard it. Subdivide the visible aggregate or the formal atom into essential atoms. Break it up into the most infinitesimal dust of being. We shall still, because of the nature of the mind and life that formed them, arrive at some utmost atomic existence. Unstable, perhaps, but always reconstituting itself in the eternal flux of force, phenomenally, and not at a mere unatomic extension incapable of contents. This is a key viewpoint. There is not at the bottom or the basis of the universe a goo, a cloudy indeterminate. there is a definite set of particles, whatever they may be called, however they may be described, which are at the basis of the cosmos. Otherwise, if matter were infinitely divisible, we would arrive at an illusory basis to the universe. We would essentially have Shankara's position in Mayavada. But Sri Aurobindo says, no, there is a point at which this descent into fragmentation ends and there is a bottom. There is not an unatomic extension incapable of contents. So the universe is founded upon reality. This is something we should note. Sri Aurobindo's philosophy is a philosophy of realism. The real is above, in Sat, and the real is here, encased in matter. It appears as matter, but it's the same reality. It is not insubstantial. It is not a void. It is substance itself. Pure substance above, apparent substance in matter. Unatomic extension of substance. Extension, which is not an aggregation, coexistence otherwise than by distribution in space, are realities of pure existence, pure substance. They are a knowledge of supermind and a principle of its dynamism, not a creative concept of the dividing mind, though mind can become aware of them behind its workings. If we're looking for that sheerness of reality, unatomic, in other words, fully unified, not separate. That exists. It doesn't have to be aggregated. It exists above in the pure substance of Sat. But that's not what mind has distributed. Mind can, in a sense, become aware of that. Behind its workings, might even become, make that hidden reality which underlies material existence, sensible to it, detectable to it. He continues, they are the reality underlying matter, these supernals, but not the phenomenon which we call matter. Mind, life, matter itself can be one with that pure existence and conscious extension in their static reality, but not operate by that oneness in their dynamic action, self-perception, and self-formation. In other words, oneness, through the play of the cosmic mind, must become disparate in material action. So our experience here, living in a world created by mind, is contrasted with what is available through the supermind and above in the original home of all in Satchit Ananda. And so we arrive at the last paragraph. Therefore, we arrive at this truth of matter, that there is a conceptive self-extension of being, a divine Maya, which works itself out in the universe as substance or object of consciousness, and which cosmic mind and life in their creative action represent through atomic division and aggregation as the thing we call matter. So it's through this process of descent that we arrive at matter. But this matter, like mind and life, is still being or Brahman in its self-creative action. It is a form of the force of conscious being, a form given by mind and realized by life. It holds within it as its own reality, consciousness concealed from itself, involved and absorbed in the result of its own self-formation, and therefore self-oblivious. So this consciousness has absorbed itself as it has distributed itself. It is not lost, but it is oblivious to its own nature. Nothing is ever truly lost in the descent into the fragmentation of the cosmos and the eventuation in matter. Reality persists. Reality abides. And however brute and void of sense it seems to us, it is yet to the secret experience of the consciousness hidden within it, delight of being offering itself to this secret consciousness as object of sensation in order to tempt that hidden Godhead out of its secrecy. Isn't that a wonderful sentence? Through that self-losing, it tempts itself to come back into disclosure of its real nature. This, the secret experience of the consciousness hidden within it. Again, remindful of the Bhagavad Gita in the 4th chapter, the 24th shloka. So, chapter 4, verse 24 in the Gita, in which the divine is described as the substance that is offered, the fire into which it is offered, the one who offers, and the one whom we meet when we work in communion with the divine. Brahmarpanam brahmahavi brahmagnam brahmanahutam brahmaivatena gantavyam brahmakarma samadhina. Being manifest as substance, force of being cast into form, into a figured self-representation of the secret self-consciousness, delight offering itself to its own consciousness as an object. What is this but Satchit Ananda? Matter is Satchit Ananda, represented to his own mental experience as a formal basis of objective knowledge, action, and delight of existence. So, despite the necessity of the cosmic mind in extending into extreme possibility the self-division capable, we still have at the basis of an apparently darkened and divided universe a field of unified being. Conscious being seeking to find itself, looking for the object of delight, hidden within itself, hidden within others, and everything, as he says, tempting that hidden Godhead out of its secrecy. So, matter is not the enemy, and Sri Aurobindo insists upon the inclusion of matter in the forming of a divine life. We don't simply live in order to find this spark of delight in ourselves, this seed of bliss, but finding it, we must use that power of Satchit Ananda to bring all in our grasp back into full divinity. We're not simply going to divinize the mind, make immortal the life force, lend renewed vivification to the body, but make the body itself divine. By what does that mean? By being aware at your own level of what this divine unity is. So the body must become aware of its basis in reality, just as the life must become aware that it's an extension of conscious force. The body must know itself as the reality of Sat. The life must know itself as the reality of Chit Tapas. The mind must know itself as the extension of the supramental awareness of Sat Chit Ananda. And the soul must bring all of this into an orchestrated harmony. Our job isn't complete. Our mission is hardly begun. We have much to do. The first thing is to know the soul within and find that spiritual self, that reality, in all things around. People and beings and becomings and material forms. I think we can read from Savitri this week, a passage which is in the Book of Beginnings in Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. The Absolute, the Perfect, the Alone, has called out of the silence his mute force, where she lay in the featureless and formless hush, guarding from time by her immobile sleep the ineffable puissance of his solitude. The Absolute, the Perfect, the Alone, has entered with his silence into space. He has fashioned these countless persons of one self. He has built a million figures of his power. He lives in all who lived in his vast alone. Space is himself, and time is only he. The Absolute, the Perfect, the Immune, one who is in us as our secret self, our mask of imperfection has assumed. He has made this tenement of flesh his own, his image in the human measure cast, that to his divine measure we might rise. Then, in a figure of divinity, the Maker shall recast us and impose a plan of Godhead on the mortal's mold, lifting our finite minds to his infinite, touching the moment with eternity. This transfiguration is earth's due to heaven. A mutual debt binds man to the Supreme. His nature we must put on as he put ours. We are sons of God and must be even as he. His human portion we must grow divine. Our life is a paradox with God for key. But meanwhile, all is a shadow cast by a dream, and to the musing and immobile spirit, life and himself don the aspect of a myth, the burden of a long, unmeaning tale. For the key is hid, and by the inconscient kept. The secret God beneath the threshold dwells, in a body obscuring the immortal spirit, a nameless resident vesting unseen powers with matter's shapes and motives beyond thought, and the hazard of an unguessed consequence, an omnipotent, indiscernible influence, he sits, unfelt by the form in which he lives, and veils his knowledge by the groping mind. A wanderer in a world his thoughts have made, he turns in a chiaroscuro of error and truth to find a wisdom that on high is his. As one forgetting, he searches for himself. As if he had lost an inner light, he seeks. As a sojourner lingering amid alien scenes, he journeys to a home he knows no more. His own self's truth he seeks. Who is the truth? He is the player who became the play. He is the thinker who became the thought. He is the many who was the silent one. In the symbol figures of the cosmic force, and in her living and inanimate signs, and in her complex tracery of events, he explores the ceaseless miracle of himself. Till the thousandfold enigma has been solved in the single light of an all-witnessing soul. And I think I'll try your patience with one more passage from the Book of Beginnings, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. A secret knowledge masked as ignorance. Fate covered with an unseen necessity, the game of chance of an omnipotent will. A glory and a rapture and a charm, the all-blissful sat unknown within the heart. Earth's pains were the ransom of its prisoned delight. A glad communion tinged the passing hours. The days were travelers on a destined road, the nights companions of his musing spirit. A heavenly impetus quickened all his breast. The trudge of time changed to a splendid march. The divine dwarf towered to unconquered worlds. Earth grew too narrow for his victory. Once only registering the heavy tread of a blind power on human littleness, life now became a sure approach to God, existence a divine experiment, and cosmos the soul's opportunity. The world was a conception and a birth of spirit in matter into living forms, and nature bore the immortal in her womb that she might climb through him to eternal life. So, next week we begin chapter 25, The Knot of Matter. So we'll meet again then. Thank you all for being with us. Namaste. Jai Ma.